Welcome to the Crosslands Church podcast. Our mission, to help you experience the life with God you've been missing. And now, a message for you.
So this is our open house service. I mean, every service is open house, but we have specially designed open house services here at Crosslands Church that are aimed for people that maybe this is all new for, or, you know, maybe you got dragged here, coerced here by a friend and wondering what you're doing here. And the one thing I was thinking about in preparation for the service is people have all kinds of barriers of understanding or emotional barriers when it comes to understanding God or believing in God. And so I had this idea about talking about scientific barriers. People say, well, you know, I believe in science, and so I don't believe in God. And I thought, you know, let's talk about that today. And so I put a video online and said, this is what we're going to talk about. And after it was online, I thought, oh, crap, what did I do? Now I bit off more than I can chew. So here we go. I'm going to talk a little bit longer than I normally do, but just because there's so much to talk about. But for me, this, well, one thing that I really noticed this, okay, I was watching a movie, and it's Oscar season, and so you think about all the great movies, and I was watching this really, really, really good movie, high-quality movie called Nacho Libre. There's a couple of luchadors, Jack Black and his friend Esqueleto, and Jack Black is a monk, right? And he's working in the monastery, and he's wrestling on the side undercover. But he's really concerned that Esqueleto is doesn't believe in God. And Esqueleto says, "I only believe in science." And so Jack Black spends the rest of the movie trying to like baptize him without him knowing it and stuff, splashing water him and stuff like that. And so that, you know, that kind of exposes that idea that there are two mutually exclusive opportunities or possibilities for us. I believe in God or believe in science, and some people are challenged by that. Some people don't really care. You know, some people are concerned with, you know, surviving or solving problems or Super Bowl preparation. Other people go, you know, I have a passing interest in that. I may be interested. I might be curious. Piques my interest. But there are other people that this is a crucial question. Like, this is the core of our belief. How do we reconcile this idea of science tells us certain things and belief in God tells us certain things? And so hopefully I want to expose you to maybe some new ways of thinking this morning. We do have a link on crosslands.live. I've mentioned that link a few times this morning. We have message notes. You can find that there, and there are some questions there. You know, where do we go from here? How do I think about this or apply this, you know, Monday to Saturday? Because our lives are more than an hour on a Sunday morning. It requires, you know, to really engage with this material requires more than that. We had time in the last service to do text messages. My number's up on the screen. If you have a comment or question relevant to the message today, if we have time, we'll entertain those publicly. When we get really good ones and we don't have time, we do put it on our Facebook page, so you can just look up that and see, you know, we'll entertain those. Oh, they're already coming in. Okay. Belief in science, belief in God. What does it even mean to believe in something? Like, what does that mean? I believe in my children. I believe in my country. I believe that my car might get me to work tomorrow. All those three of those things are completely different things. They mean different things. And for some people, belief in God is just reduced to I believe that God, whatever that is, exists. And is that it? And so then we have this tension where we understand that belief in God also entails all kinds of other beliefs, but belief in science, some people say that it undermines that. There's this tension that if you believe in science, you can't believe in God, and vice versa. Why is that? And let's be honest, some people, there are really smart people on both sides of the equation. If you differ in opinion, it doesn't mean that the person you differ with is stupid. Really smart people believe in God, and really smart people don't. So what do you do with that? I think it starts out, one of the explanations for belief in God, and it's kind of a reductionist explanation, says the idea of belief in God happened when people couldn't explain certain things. So we have certain things that we know, and the things that we don't know, we say, well, you know, God did that. But what's happened over time is as we've increased in knowledge, what we don't understand has gotten smaller. There's more we understand. There's less that we don't understand. And so we have our, you know, our physics, our biology, and philosophy, and chemistry, and we add to that over time psychology and sociology and a whole bunch of other ologies. And what happens is what we don't know, there are these little gaps. There's actually a phrase for that, the God of the gaps. So we have all these things that we know, but there are little things we don't know. We say, well, that God is the explanation for that. Stephen Hawking said in one of his books before he died, something like, there's no need to invoke God anymore because we have just as good models for the explanation of reality. There's just no requirement for that. Is that all there is? And some people who do believe in God see science as a threat because of that. Because science answers questions and maybe, well, now I don't know where to fit God in. There's not enough gaps. The gaps aren't big enough. I remember there was an email that went around when email first started going around, and it's still going around today. Maybe this came across your computer. The idea that bumblebees can't fly. There's no understanding our laws of aerodynamics. We can't understand how bumblebees fly. And so, aha, people say, well, God exists because, look, we don't understand how bumblebees can fly. And I'm not sure what's going on there. So do they imagine that God is holding up bumblebees with invisible threads, right, and directing them around? Or it's some kind of magic or miracle or something like that? The reality is that just because we don't understand it doesn't mean there isn't an explanation. And what has actually happened over time is people have investigated that and understood some new aerodynamic principles by which bumblebees can fly. So what do you do if your belief in God is dependent on whether bumblebees can fly or not? We have an explanation, so now you don't believe in God? It's kind of weird, but that's the God of the gaps. On the other hand, we have this idea of science, and I mean, there's all kinds of definitions, so I have my own, and let's see if you agree with it or not. Science is both a body of knowledge, so when people say science says, what they really mean is scientists say, but there's this idea that there's a body of knowledge that we've understood by evaluating facts and data and so on, but it's also a process, a specific evidence-based method of collaboratively collecting knowledge. So we have a whole bunch of scientists all doing experiments, the same kinds of experiments in the same kinds of ways, so that people aren't guessing, right? They're not guessing on this. If they're doing controlled studies, experiments, and a lot of it doesn't even take genius. It just takes a lot of hard work. You set up the experiment, you do it, you draw your conclusion, and then somebody else has to be able to repeat that experiment in order to verify it. So we draw conclusions through repeatable experiments. Now I have to say that there's certain things you can quote-unquote experiment with in your own experience, but what science is specifically aimed at is the natural world, the physical world. It can only experiment with the physical world. There's some scientific theories, some mathematical models that describe the way things might be in the multiverse or whatever, but we can't test those. We can't test our other universes. We can only test ours. So your model should be able to make a prediction, you should be able to have a test and then see whether that's true. And a lot of the things that people are investigating might be very speculative because it goes beyond our own universe. So we're testing the physical world according to discovered and discoverable laws of nature. And we call this methodological naturalism, okay? I could just read it on the screen there because it's a lot of syllables. That's your first big word for today, methodological naturalism. What that means is when you're doing experiments, miracles are not allowed. You can't do an experiment. So here's a cartoon, and I don't know if you can read at the back. Two scientists, and the guy at the bottom, he's saying to the other guy, I think you should be more explicit here in step two, because step two is then a miracle occurs. You can't do that in experiments, right? You have to have this understanding of the way things work. Now, what some people do with that is they say that science, because scientists is not equipped to address a miracle, then miracles don't exist. There's a logical leap there. Scientists can't explain certain things, therefore it's not real. So, but science has a hard time explaining something like justice or love or beauty. I mean, there are reductionist explanations about why we experience those things, but it can't explain those things. How do you quantify art? You can't. We can talk about our reactions to art, but we can't define it through science. So the problem is that what works at the methodological level is people expand that and say what works at that level is true of everything that there is. So they say if it's not physical, if it's not natural, it doesn't exist, and that's how we understand the world, and that's called philosophical naturalism. So it isn't just our practice of science. There's a mindset that says, well, that's true of everything that there is. And that's where the problem lies. That the practice becomes the philosophy. And so our kids go through elementary school and high school, they go to university, and they're taught that here's what science is, and it means everything. That second step is what causes the conflict. Because it's true of the practice, it's not necessarily true of everything. And hopefully I can kind of convince you of that over time today. So what happens is that science itself becomes the mirror opposite of God of the gaps. So yeah, there's still gaps in knowledge, but the expectation is over time science is going to answer every question. Okay? So I do want to cover three things before I move on. Three statements that I hope you'll just go with me. Don't turn off as soon as I say it. And I'll explain each one as we go. The first one is we all believe in science. Some people say, well, I believe in God, so I don't believe in science. Well, belief in doesn't just mean I believe that something exists, because everybody believes that scientists exist. But belief in is also demonstrating confidence and trust. I believe in something. I believe in my kids. I have confidence in them. I have trust in them. I believe in my car. I have confidence in it, right? Whether it is what something represents, what it has potential for, what it can do. Some people say, I don't believe in science, but then when they get their leftovers out of the fridge, they put it in the microwave. Right? And there's some pretty wacky theories out there, quantum theory, right? And if you really look into that, it's crazy, but your microwave oven depends on it. You get sick, you go to the doctor, I want to send you for an MRI. Well, if you get your MRI, you're depending on science. Sorry, that's just the way it is. There is no, MRI doesn't happen by, it's not magic resonance imaging, okay? You have a cell phone in your pocket. Guess what? If you use that, if you're counting on that, you're depending on science. So everybody at some level believes in science. We do. Maybe there's certain things about it you don't agree with, but part of it, everybody believes in science. Second thing, we all believe in the supernatural. This is where we all have some kind of religious belief, and this is where people go, they shut down, right? No, I don't. I only believe in facts. Okay, if you equate religion with belief in the supernatural, there are things that go beyond natural laws, and maybe you don't believe me. If you're a hardcore naturalist, you probably believe that the universe came into being through the Big Bang, and when you look at that theory, it says that at about the one Planck second mark, which is a very, very short time after that, all of our physical laws, all of our natural laws and physical concepts came into being, which means before that, they didn't exist. Natural laws did not exist before that. Before that, something beyond natural happened. By definition, we call that supernatural, but maybe you don't like that definition. There are certain point in time where if you're a hardcore naturalist, you have to acknowledge natural laws did not exist at that time because they hadn't yet come into being. That's an interesting thought, eh? Okay, finally, we all have faith. Maybe you don't like that either. We all have underlying beliefs and values, and here's why people don't like that, because we have come to believe that faith means blind belief. Faith is believing something without evidence. I was flipping through, actually I read the whole book, Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, and one of his big arguments that completely falls down is because he defines faith as evidence without belief. That's not what it means. That's an Enlightenment distortion of the concept. The Enlightenment was like 1700s, where faith was opposed to rationalism or reason. You have reason and you have faith, as if faith is unreasonable, which is absolutely not true. That's not what it means. I have faith in my wife. I trust her. It's not based on no evidence. I didn't go on a dating site, meet her for the first time and say, let's get married. That didn't happen. I built a history of experience and trust. The biblical word for faith means that kind of trust, but it also means faithfulness. So when I demonstrate faith in my wife, I'm also demonstrating faithfulness to my wife. That's exactly the same thing. That's the biblical word. Faith and faithfulness are exactly the same thing. But faith requires some kind of evidence for me to have faith in my wife. It's verified beforehand and after the fact. So we all have faith. We all have foundational belief in things we can't prove. Everybody does. You cannot exist in this world. You cannot move forward in this world without trusting in something that you can't prove with evidence. Physical evidence. The problem is that a lot of us have unexamined foundational beliefs. Maybe I'm exposing you to a concept here before you've never thought of before. If it's unexamined, then there's no difference between that and blind faith. You're believing something without evidence because you've never actually examined it to see if it's true. So here's a little bit of a tangent. Three ways that we know things. How do we actually know something? Okay, I'm going to try to go through this fairly quickly. The first thing, we know things because of authority. Somebody told us. Now, we're the product of our culture, and we don't like to believe that we believe things because of authority. We don't trust authority in our culture ever since the 60s. And there's all kinds of reasons for that. A big one that a lot of people don't know about in North America had to do with the Vietnam War. So before the Vietnam War, people trusted their government to not lie, even if they didn't vote for them. And what happened was they found out after the war that the government knew they were losing the war and they continued sending soldiers, knowing that they were going to be pulling out anyway. And all of a sudden people said, the government has been lying to us. Now we don't trust authority at all. You partner that with the whole hippie movement in the 60s. We have, in our culture, we have an innate resentment of authority, and we really don't believe that we believe things because people told us. I test everything. I evaluate evidence. I don't believe something just because somebody told you. Okay, so why do you brush your teeth? Did you ever do an experiment to try not brushing your teeth and see what happened? No, we brush our teeth because our parents told us. That's authority. We don't just brush our teeth because our parents told us. I brush my teeth because every year the dentist tells me good job and I feel a sense of self-affirmation. The dentist told me good job. Yeah, he's in a position of authority. In fact, the toothpaste we buy it based on the fact that 9 out of 10 dentists recommend it. The guy's got a white lab coat, so I trust him. That's the way it works. I don't know the guy in the commercial, but he's got a white lab coat on. Right? We believe things because of authority. We also, these days, and part of this is due to social media, there's an increasing authority of popular opinion. It must be true because everybody believes it. It doesn't work. McDonald's has served billions and billions of people. That doesn't make it good. Something is popular, everybody believes it, doesn't make it true. And we've seen that throughout history. History tells us that authority can go wrong. Right? At one point, the people in authority were saying that the earth is at the center of the universe. And we go, yeah, his authority was wrong. Sometimes those in authority can be well-intended but ignorant. And sometimes they can actually be malicious. They don't have our best interests at heart. But authority is one way out of three that we learn things. The second thing is experience. As a child, did you ever have your mom or dad say, don't touch the stove, it's hot? And at some point you test it, right? Hopefully you only test it once. But this is how we learn through experience. At a certain point, we learn that certain people are trustworthy and certain people are not. That's one way that we evaluate authority, through experience. Here's something that's interesting. Science is experience systematized. That's what it is. It's collectively done. A whole bunch of people are taking experience and repeating it and trying new things and writing it down. They're codifying it with checks and balances. Science is supposed to be self-correcting, okay, until it's reached a level of authority. The scientists said it. They did the experiments. So when people say, well, I only do things based on evidence and I check it all out. Well, has anybody here done an experiment on the Large Hadron Collider? Probably not. But the scientists did, so we believe it. Unless you believe that there's a conspiracy theory in all of science. And some people actually believe that, but they still use their cell phone. Right? So we learn through experience. Experimentation of science is methodical, collective experience that builds a body of knowledge. So authority, experience, and we learn through intuition. Now, you might not believe me on this one. Intuition is basically what rings true. It's not always correct. Our intuition isn't always correct, but neither is our experience. Studies have shown that people's memory can be faulty, can be really creative. In fact, I could give you a neat experience with LSD that doesn't make it LSD, that doesn't make it true. Like you have a wild experience. Is it true? No, it's LSD. But our intuition can inform that. Authority can inform that. Our intuition, there's quite a few layers. Some of it is encoded right in our DNA. We have instincts. Nobody taught us to eat when we're hungry. It's an instinct. Self-preservation is an instinct. We absorb truth from culture, so that informs our intuition. And our intuition is informed, it's adjusted through experience. You ever watch the Blue Jays? You ever watch Superman, Kevin Pillar, catch a fly ball? You know, he goes all out and dives and catches the ball, and it's incredible. You know what he's not doing when he does that? He's not doing physics equations in his head. He's not calculating the acceleration of the ball off the bat and factoring in gravity and longitudinal motion and versus vertical and all that. He's not doing that. He does it intuitively because he's caught so many balls through experience, it's now second nature to him. And there's also something that this might be disputed, but I believe that each one of us has a spirit inside us that informs us through our conscience. That's part of intuition. We have just a sense that something is right or wrong. Now, we combine these three things, authority, experience, intuition, and what we do is we create a mental model of the world. We have a worldview. This is how we understand the world around us. It's how we understand ourselves. It's how we understand other people. A mental model of the world. And that's how we get through life. It's like a story, a narrative, and we fit everything into that story. There was an experiment that was done. They had a bunch of people watch a video of people playing basketball, and they were told to count how many times the ball changed hands. There were about six or seven people throwing the basketball around, and so you're watching the video, you're going, okay, one, two, three, and you're counting. It was about 10 minutes long, fairly long for that. After the video, they turn it off, and they said, okay, how many people saw the man in the gorilla suit? Most people didn't see that while that was happening, there was a guy in a gorilla suit who danced through the basketball right in front of them, and they watched the video again. Sure enough, there he is. Well, how could you not see that? Because they were focused on something else. And this is what our mental models do. Our mental models screen out, they filter out excess information that's considered unimportant. All of us do this all the time. I heard a scientist talking about this recently, and he said, there's so much visual data that comes into your brain every second, your brain is physically not equipped to handle it. So our brain filters, we don't see certain things. We don't hear certain things. You go to the mall and it's full of noise and your brain filters it out. That's why people with hearing aids have a hard time because hearing aids don't filter it out the way your brain does. But you go to the mall and there's noise and then one day you hear somebody call your name and your brain picks that out because it fits your filter. Your brain's like kind of listening to it while you're not even paying attention. We have mental models. So they screen out data and they filter in what's important like blinders on a horse. We know which way to go. And so here's how that works. Underneath everything that we believe, underneath everything we say that we believe, we have foundational presuppositions which support and inform our mental models. So like these columns support a bridge. So what happens is we have data that's coming in all the time through our seven or eight senses, taste, touch, hearing, sight, smell, balance. I mean, you could take touch and divide it up into pressure, pain, and temperature. And you have a sense that most people don't know about. You close your eyes and you have a sense of where your hand is at any point. So we have about seven or eight or nine senses, depending on how you define them. And that's how we interact with the world around us. We get all this data. And we evaluate the data according to the narrative. But over time, we can build and adjust our foundational presuppositions based on the information that comes in. You know, like a baby closes his eyes and the world disappears. It's gone. And they open their eyes and the world comes back. But they learn over time that they create a mental model where that the world doesn't disappear, doesn't cease to exist when they close their eyes. It continues to exist. It's a mental model, right? And so the data informs that. But here's where the problem is. Because as a set of blinders, our mental models inform what we look at and how we understand the world around us. So we get all this data, but we're not evaluating it necessarily accurately because we're filtering a lot of it out. And what happens is that we're introduced to something called confirmation bias. Confirmation bias is you absorb the information that confirms what you already believe and you reject information that contradicts what you believe. So some people would say vaccines cause autism. And then they pursue all the articles online that confirm that, and they don't look at the articles that reject that, and vice versa. Confirmation bias. We'll only entertain data that confirms what we already believe, and that's a mess. Because how could you know what's true of the world if you have blinders on, your mental model is limiting, and you only accept the data that confirms what you already believe? Now, hopefully what happens over time is challenges slip through. And it can happen gradually, or it can happen as a crisis. For example, you have people that grow up with a Sunday school version of Christianity, and one day they pray for something and it doesn't happen. And they're expecting, well, God answers prayer, and all of a sudden, God didn't answer my prayer. Now what? What does that do to your foundational belief? Maybe your foundational belief was wrong. Or a tragedy happens in the world, and I don't know how to deal with that. Maybe there's something wrong with your foundational belief. Or maybe you go to university and you learn some science, and you go, oh no, what do I do with this? Our mental models are always smaller than reality, our mental models are always smaller than God. So, for many people, most of the time, these foundational presuppositions, they remain unexamined until a crisis comes, whether it comes gradually or all at once. So what's your foundation? What are your basic beliefs? They're almost impossible to identify because we just take them for granted. What's at the bottom of our foundational beliefs, that the way, way, way deep down, is a faith choice, an unprovable belief, what some people would call an axiom, something I just accept to be true because I can't prove it, but it just seems true to me. It's self-evident. It's confirmed by intuition. It's affirmed by evidence, maybe if I don't have confirmation bias, but it can be controlled by my confirmation bias. So we have these bottom foundational things we assume to be true. And they require a leap of faith. Always. Every single one of us makes leaps of faith. We all make decisions with incomplete information. We have mental models. We fill in the blanks. Now, that's not blind belief. That's not empty faith. It's coming to a reasonable conclusion with imperfect information. So at the root of it, okay, so here's where the tension comes down. What's at the root of it? As a follower of Jesus, as somebody who believes in the existence of God, I understand that the universe is rational because a rational God created it. If you don't believe in God, you have to make a faith choice that the universe is rational, because there's no other reason to say that the universe is rational, that the universe can be understood, that I can understand it. In fact, it takes faith to accept that the universe is rational at all. People say, well, you believe in God, that's a fabrication, it's wishful thinking. There's no evidence for that. The person who believes in God says, okay, the universe is rational because God exists, so I should be able to understand it. But if I don't believe that God exists, then I'm trusting my brain, which is the result of blind chance and natural selection, to give me accurate information about the universe around me. Now, I'm not saying that's wrong. I'm saying that's a faith choice, that you would actually trust your brain. There was a Oxford professor, John Lennox, and he was challenging one of the more vocal atheists in the world. And he said, how do you understand the world? Like, what is your brain? And the guy said, I know where you're going with this. My brain is the result of a blind, mindless process. That's what it comes down to. And John Lennox turned back around and said, if your computer was the product of a blind, mindless process, would you trust it? He's asked a number of people that. If your computer was a result of a blind, mindless process, would you trust it? And nobody has yet to say yes. Everybody says no. It's a faith choice to say, I trust that my reason can actually understand the universe around me. And that's no different from saying, I believe that God created everything, and that's why I'm rational, that's why I'm reasonable. It's a faith choice. We all make those. Here's another one. We believe that the individual has supreme value. It's how our culture works. The individual has supreme value. Now, why do I believe that? Because I believe God created humanity to have supreme value. But if you don't believe in God, you just have to accept that as a faith choice, or you don't accept that, and now we have bigger problems. The individual has supreme value. There's a leap of faith. It's rational. We've all done it. And it's reasonable to make a leap of faith. We have to do it. We can't move forward in the world without it. So here's where I think the problem with naturalism is, philosophical naturalism, the idea that nature is all there is, because people will say, only that which can be measured physically is true. Only that which can be measured physically, not necessarily sensed, but measured. Only that which can be physically measured is true. My question is, can you measure that statement? It's self-defeating. You can't measure that statement. It's a philosophical choice to get there. So, how do we turn this around? Psalm 19:1 says, let me look it up. The heavens proclaim the glory of God. The skies display his craftsmanship. So as a believer in God, I believe that the universe, the physical reality of the universe, doesn't lie about God. We can understand something about him through that. And so I don't believe that there's a conspiracy of scientists. I think the science tells us, in general, what's true about the world. Yeah, sure, it can make mistakes, but it's intended to be self-correcting. That's how the process works. So for me, science is not a threat to my faith in God. As a follower of Jesus, I should expect that that would be true. The universe is rational, that the natural world is legitimate. Now, I think sometimes theology and science as interpretations of reality, they answer completely different questions. Completely different questions. So somebody might ask, why is the water boiling? Well, because I've added heat to it to excite the molecules to the point where the liquid state breaks down and molecules are freed into a gaseous state, which is a legitimate scientific answer to that question. But the answer, the why answer to that question might be because I'm making tea. And around the world, that's usually the more typical answer. People aren't asking the how question. Science answers the how question legitimately, correctly. But it doesn't answer the why question. Do you have a purpose? Some people would say purpose doesn't exist as such in the grand scheme of things. Is there meaning? God answers the meaning question. At some point, we all live with uncertainty. But it is not irrational to make a faith decision. We all do it. It's reasonable. We have to do that as humans. What's your faith decision? Okay, so now here's where my problem is here on a Sunday morning at 11:44. How do you get this great philosophical concept about making a leap of faith, having uncertainty, and boil that down, to make tea, to this idea of Jesus and the resurrection? Because that's the core of Christianity. That's the core of the Christian message. That somehow, you know, Jesus is this human, beyond human figure that went to his death and rose from the dead, and the naturalist goes, that doesn't happen, can't happen. You can't do that in an experiment. You can't replicate that. So there's two parts to that. The first part is that God is not just, the idea of God is not just an explanation for the gaps, the things we don't understand. The idea is that God created us because he loves us. He created us to love us, and Jesus is his self-revelation. Jesus is him communicating to us. And that Jesus coming, dying, rising again is the center of Christianity, and there's a difference between a scientific fact, which is replicated in a laboratory experiment, and a historical fact, which is not repeatable. Napoleon lost the Battle of Waterloo. We cannot do an experiment to repeat that and verify it. It's a historical fact. Now, you can look at data around that. You can make predictions of what you might expect if he lost that battle and what you might see archaeologically or whatever, but you can do the same thing with Jesus' existence, death, and resurrection. You can look at the facts around it, historical facts. Some people would challenge it and say, okay, so I'm going to give you a few challenges here, and I'm going to go over them really quickly. Each one could be an entire message in itself. First one probably didn't even exist. Even really skeptical scholars. Richard Dawkins himself says there's no reason to believe that Jesus didn't actually exist. A man named Jesus didn't exist 2,000 years ago. Bart Ehrman is one of the top New Testament scholars. I think he's an extreme skeptic. And he says, of course Jesus existed. He doesn't believe Jesus was God. He doesn't believe Jesus died and rose again. But he said, of course somebody named Jesus existed. We have all kinds of data to support that. Some people say, well, maybe Jesus existed, but he didn't die and rise again because he probably didn't die anyway. You know, he was knocked unconscious or whatever. Okay, really, really quick answer to that. The Romans were really good executioners. Okay, they were not fooled. Like, they knew how to kill people. They knew when somebody was dead. Okay, I could answer that longer, but that's a really simple answer to that. People say those sources aren't trustworthy. It's all legendary. Okay, the sources are really early. There are like thousands and thousands of New Testament documents, things written by eyewitnesses and so on that, you know, we have Julius Caesar's Gallic Wars. It's kind of like a diary, his justification of his own events that happened, you know, sometime in the first century BC. We have 12 copies of that dating to 1000 AD. Those are the oldest ones we have, that's all. There are thousands of New Testament documents that were written within like less than a couple of decades after these events that people are talked about. And there's internal evidence. Like, there's something called the embarrassment factor, right? People are writing their own story, and they're not making themselves look good. If I was fabricating something, I'm not going to be an idiot in my own story. In fact, the first witnesses to Jesus' resurrection were women. You might go, why does that matter? Because if you're in ancient Greek culture or Jewish culture, they're not credible witnesses. You're not going to lie about that. I'm sorry, women, that's just the way it was back then. They wouldn't write that if it wasn't true. We have a messianic movement, okay? There were lots of messianic movements. They all died when the Messiah died. A messianic movement does not perpetuate if the Messiah is killed. Well, at best, you could transfer that messianic title over to his brother. Jesus had a brother, and they didn't call him a Messiah. Jesus had a brother who didn't even believe in him until after these events. And the movement kept on going. How can that happen in a fiercely monotheistic culture that was very resistant to all of the ideas that they were saying? Some people claim it was a rehash of a pagan argument. I don't know if you've come across this online, the idea that Jesus is a rehash of the idea of Horus, the Egyptian god, and they look at all those parables or parallels between the two. Really, if you want to reinvent Jesus, if you want to implement paganism in ancient Judea, you don't have to invent something new. There was all kinds of paganism around they could have picked. And the second thing is that all the things that they said about Horus, I actually went and looked at the Egyptian Book of the Dead. None of the stuff they say about Horus is true in that. You look it up online. All of this stuff was fabricated by a self-educated Egyptologist in the late 1800s called Gerald Massey, who has been totally discredited, and people still appeal to him as a basis for that argument. He did, like, he really just shoveled it all up and made it up, and people spread it around. Well, I saw it on the internet, so it must be true. And finally, I had an argument with a guy online once, and he said, are there any witnesses that weren't Christians that acknowledge that Jesus was Son of God? And, well, that's a meaningless question. How would somebody that doesn't believe Jesus is the Son of God say, well, I'm convinced that he is, but I'm not a Christian? Like, it doesn't make any sense. And it wasn't till months later that I recognized, well, there was one. His name was Paul. He was completely antagonistic to the whole movement. He became convinced that Jesus was the Messiah of Israel that rose from the dead, and he got on side. There's your hostile witness right there. Unfortunately, he no longer is hostile. Well, fortunately, he's no longer hostile. He's written a bunch of books in the New Testament. So here's the last challenge. Okay, that's all well and true. Maybe that magic event happened and changed history or not, but it's irrelevant today. Okay, so here's why I want to appeal to authority. There are millions of people that would say that Jesus died, rose from the dead, and has changed my life. I would be one of them. And you go, well, authority's not enough. Great. Well, you can confirm authority with your own experience. My challenge to you today would be that you would allow your foundational presuppositions to crack open and entertain the idea that not only that God exists, but that he has revealed himself through Jesus. Just allow that, like, challenge that, let that idea entertain it for a while. Because he will meet you if you turn towards him. We all need to evaluate our foundational beliefs. If you want to live authentically, if you've been brought up with Sunday school, or you've been brought up in an atheist family, to be the best that we can be, whether we believe in God or not, to live authentically, we need to evaluate our foundational beliefs and say, is this true? Now, you may be sitting there today, and I've never heard that articulated before, at least in that way, and maybe there's a crack of my skepticism that's you know, maybe there's something there. Maybe I've raised your curiosity. We have a program just for you. It's called Alpha. This is where questions are allowed. And it's a weekly thing. You can sign up for this on crosslands.live. In fact, if you have questions about it, there's a table in the lobby that the people that run it are there, and they'd be happy to answer your questions. And I'm actually going to call the worship team up. We're gonna do a song together. I have a few, a lot of text messages. I'm just going to do a few text messages. And then we're going to do some music together. It's interesting. I believe in history. Yeah, so I believe in science. I believe in God. I believe in history. I believe all those things corroborate each other, but that's cool. The sun is 149.6 million kilometers distance from the Earth. God, in his wisdom, placed the sun the right distance from Earth. Any closer, the Earth would burn up. With all the planets in the heaven, God placed each planet strategically. If not, they would fall down to Earth. Well, they would fall into the sun, actually, or away. At the chemical level, plants and animals contain the same DNA shape. Human DNA is a code made up of four chemical bases. God left his code present in all living things. Science proves there is a God. Science cannot prove there is a God. Proof is the area of mathematics and logic. Now, there's evidence. That's different from proof. We weigh it. The other thing is that, yeah, the sun is 149.6 million kilometers distance from the Earth. Sometimes we have an elliptical orbit, so we're not always the same distance from the sun. At the same time, if we didn't have Jupiter in the asteroid belt, we probably would have had a lot more comets hitting Earth. So that's an interesting coincidence. We're also in the Goldilocks zone of our solar system, which is also in the Goldilocks system. I mean, that's the perfect place for habitable life in our galaxy. So there's a lot of those neat coincidences. And DNA is another interesting one, because The SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, they're aiming radio telescopes at the sky looking for intelligent life. And how would we recognize if we found it? Well, it would be, you'd see patterned communication, but we've already found that. Quasars, or pulsars, they pulse, right? So you get a pattern. It's a pulse on and off, on and off. But it would also be information rich. So if you have a pattern signal that's information rich, we would look at that and say, that's intelligent life. There's no other source. Well, DNA is patterned and information rich. Where did that come from? That's a question. There's a whole bunch of other probably really, really good text messages, but we just don't have time to entertain them right now. But thanks. I will try to respond to each one of these individually, or we'll put them on the Facebook page, so keep an eye out for that. I've already mentioned the Alpha program. If your curiosity is piqued about some of these things, and you want to know more, they're on our crossens.live on the message notes at the bottom. There's a link to an organization that does debates, and they're long, like they're like an hour or something like that. And they'll put people like on both sides of the question, right? So I believe in God, I don't believe in God, or whatever. There's a whole bunch of them. There's hours and hours and hours of listening pleasure for you while you drive to work or whatever. If you're interested, there's a lot of content there as well. We're gonna do a song, but I'm gonna come back after because I want to give people an opportunity to respond to this. So I'm gonna hand it over to Wade, but sit tight and I'll be back. There's a challenge facing each one of us today. It's not so much the how God made, but the why God made. And I believe that God made each one of you to be the best you that you can possibly be, and that only happens in relationship with Him. And so maybe I've exposed you to ideas you never heard before, and maybe the opportunity that this would be true has kind of cracked open, allowing for the possibility that maybe there's more than you've ever considered before, including the claims of Jesus. And I want to give you the opportunity to respond to that today. God invites us into relationship. Now, how do you get into that? It's as simple as ABC. It starts with admitting our need for Him. Admitting that as much as I have a mental model that maybe is or isn't working for me, there might be more than that. I admit that I want that more. That God is bigger than whatever my mental model is. And the second thing is belief. To step into something like that, I have to acknowledge that possibility exists. And more specifically, that Jesus died, rose again, so that I could have that relationship with my Creator. And the C stands for commit. Like any relationship, it requires opening up and moving towards the other person. God has already moved towards us. He sent Jesus to send His message of love, and we can engage with Him by moving towards Him. I believe that one way to make that step is to do something practical, something, physical. And, we at Crossroads Church here, we're a community of followers of Jesus. We're striving to do that life. We do it imperfectly, of course. It's why we're here together, to encourage one another to move forward together. But I would invite you into our community. But the second thing is to do a single, simple, practical step. The easiest way to do that is get on the crossens.live app or the website, fill in your contact information, and there's just a checkbox. I'm deciding to be a follower of Jesus today. Now, maybe you're still exploring, and you can check the box, I want to know more about this. But there's something that we need to do, and I would encourage you to respond. We're going to close the service with a song, but immediately after the service, we turn Theater One into a prayer room. And I would encourage you to stay, pray, consider those questions, consider your foundational beliefs, maybe allow God to crack open your skepticism and reveal Himself to you, which He wants to do. Allow for the possibility that He would do that, and maybe even take the risk and throw a prayer up if you've never done that before. Allow God to reveal Himself to you. Take the opportunity to work through this, think through this, engage. We're going to have this the room open for another 20 minutes, half an hour to facilitate that. And I would encourage you to do that. I'm going to hand it back to Wade as we close this song.
You've been listening to the Crosslands Church podcast. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes or the Google Play Store so that it comes straight to your device. And to find out more about Crosslands Church, you can visit us at crosslands.ca. Join us next week for another message to help you experience the life with God you've been missing.